Romans chapter 14. In order to understand Romans chapter 14, we got to do a little background again. Paul, who wrote the book of Romans, was himself Jewish, you know this, of the tribe of Benjamin, raised to be a Hebrew of the Hebrews, studied at the feet of Gamaliel, knew very well and very clearly all the details, the ins and outs of what we call the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law was an external law. The law of Moses was an external law. What I mean by that is, at the time that Moses brought the law to the children of Israel, the nation of Israel, God remained external to his people. He did not indwell them. The sign and seal of the new covenant is the Holy Spirit indwelling people. But it never indwelt human beings prior to the crucifixion. Jesus said plainly in John that one of the reasons he was dying was for the Holy Spirit to come and for the first time indwell humans. He will be with you and he will be in you. That was a brand new concept. When the children of Israel were 40 years wandering in the wilderness, God fed them manna every day. Their shoes didn't wear out. Their clothes didn't wear out. He cared for them for 40 years, but he also led them by a pillar of smoke during the day and a pillar of fire by night. And he was always over there. He was always external to them. Once a year, the high priest would go into the temple and go into the Holy of Holies, and he would meet there with God and sacrifice for the sins of the entire nation once a year on the Day of Atonement. But no one had the individual right to go to God firsthand. If Joel wanted to go talk to God about his own problems and sins, he couldn't go to God. God was separate from him, external to him, completely holy. Joel was completely a sinner and had no access to God. He had to go to a priest who would sacrifice on his behalf, and then this priest would lay his hands on a goat. They would kill that goat, they would pour that blood on the altar, and blood from that altar once a year was taken into the Holy of Holies. God would come down and either accept or reject that sacrifice. Now that was Joel's way of having his sins temporarily remitted so that God wouldn't punish him for them. He had to have an intercessor take care of that for him, but he couldn't go directly to God. Which is why it was so startling when Paul would say, as we saw earlier in the book of Romans and then in the book of Hebrews, it says that we have access to God one-on-one to go to, as Paul says, come boldly to the throne of grace. That was a completely anti-Mosaic kind of thought. If you were a first century Jew, you knew that God was in his temple and God was in the heavens, but you needed somebody to go intercede between you and God. You couldn't go do it yourself. You weren't allowed to go in. The new covenant says that God so indwells you that you have direct access now to the Father, that you can pray to him directly and he'll listen to you, that he is in you, he is with you, that the Son paid the price for you and opened up this pathway of communication between you and God directly. That's why you no longer need a priest per se. You go speak to the high priest Christ. You lay your body down, the living sacrifice, as opposed to a dead animal sacrifice. And so all of those types and shadows of Old Testament worship are fulfilled in New Covenant worship in your ability to individually, singularly go to God. So here's the big concept. Old Covenant, Mosaic Covenant law was external activity. To keep the Mosaic law, all you had to do was do the external stuff. Do this, do this, do this, do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. If you just simply did what it said to do and don't do what it says not to do, you had kept that law. The problem with that law, according to the book of Hebrews, is that it couldn't save anybody because nobody could ever keep it perfectly. And that if you were to establish your own righteousness by the Mosaic law, you would have to keep it continuously, perfectly, constantly, and never slip up in any one part. Because to be guilty of one part was to be guilty of the whole thing. So then Paul would say that the purpose of the law, the reason that the law was added, we saw this earlier in Romans, was to make sin all the more obviously sin. The purpose of the law was not to save anybody. The purpose of the Mosaic law was not to give anybody righteousness on which they could go to God and say, look, I kept your law, so now I'm righteous, so you have to save me, despite the fact that that's a very popular church concept, that you can achieve personal righteousness to the degree that God will accept you on the basis of your righteousness. The law was there for the purpose not of saving you and making you righteous. The law was there to make you guilty. The whole purpose of the law was to show you you can't be good enough. Got all that? So now Paul comes along, and you've got the first century church, which is predominantly Jewish, and they're still trying to figure out that balance of Moses and Jesus. And they're still trying to figure out how much of the Torah, the law of Moses, the Pentateuch, the first five books, how much of that that we've been raised with, that we've lived in, that we've done all our life, how much of that do we inculcate into this new Christianity, this new covenant? If you're a 60-year-old Jewish guy, let's say, and you understand that Christ was the Messiah predicted in the Old Testament, and you're very happy about this, hooray, we found the Messiah, this is very exciting to you, your natural inclination, though, is to still continue to do the law that you did anyway. You've been doing it, you would continue doing it. You'd keep taking as much of the Torah into your Christianity as you possibly could. The whole book of Galatians is about that conflict, that there were those from Jerusalem, from James, John, and Peter, who were coming to new Gentile converts and saying, well, if you're converted to Christianity, Christianity is a fulfilled Judaism, so you need to keep the law. And they kept trying to impose the law on the church. And Paul was constantly battling that no, converted Gentiles don't have to keep the law. This is a completely new covenant. It's a covenant of grace. They don't have to be circumcised. They don't have to keep the law. That battle ensued for the first 100 years in the church, very dramatically, between converted Gentiles and converted Jews. And of course, the Roman church is converted Jews and converted Gentiles. And as I told you in the introduction to Romans, it were Jews and Gentiles in Rome who were all practicing Christianity. But there was a huge conflict between them over this very subject. What do you do about the external law, the Torah, what Moses said? How much of it is still legitimate? How much of it do you still have to do? Now, all of you know who have grown up in the church that battle is not over. It's 2,000 years later, and there are still plenty of churches out there telling you what you gotta do and not do to be accepted by God. And they can give you a list. They have their particular criteria, some of which is biblical, some of which isn't. Some criteria in some churches would say that Jolene can't come in dressed that way. She's got jeans on, pants on women, no good. There are plenty of very fundamentalist churches that would say that's the wrong dress for a woman. Bruce's outfit wouldn't fit. John and I were driving through Dallas, Texas one time, and we happened to be outside the Dallas Convention Center at the very time that the Southern Baptist Convention was holding their convention there, and they apparently just got out as we hit the light in front of the convention center because there was this parade of guys in white shirts and black ties with very neat little haircuts that all looked up. It was like somebody inside was cookie-cuttering little men and sending them out into the street. So we're sitting there, our long hair and our T-shirts and our rent-a-car, and we're sitting there watching them go by. Now, their instant assumption by looking at John and I was that we needed to be saved. And they surrounded our car. I thought, well, you know, they're either going to roll the car. You know, I'm thinking L.A. riots because we're living in L.A. at the time. And I thought, this is very weird. There's a riot with guys in white shirts and black ties. This is really going to get... And they tried very hard to convert us. You know, they asked us if we knew Jesus and had we made our peace with Jesus and did we want to know the Lord and have we ever said the sinner's prayer and have we... They each had a separate line that they wanted to throw at us. I couldn't wait for that light to turn green because I dropped it into drive and just started moving until they cleared the way and let us through. Now, my point was, they all genuinely believed that that mode of dress somehow sanctified them to God in a way that, say, Marcos' mode of dress today does not. They were so busy with the externals that they paid no attention to the internals. They had no idea, looking at John and I, whether or not we were Christian people. Nor did they bother to find out.
Nor would they have believed you.
Nor would they have believed us because they believed that your religion would have created an externalization just like theirs. And since my particular externalization doesn't match theirs, they automatically assumed I was not saved. They're in for a great surprise. And, you know, God bless them, I hope they all make it to heaven in their white shirts and their black ties, and they can have their corner where that group sits, and they're going to be very, very surprised to see me and Joel show up. You know, they're going to be very surprised at the people who show up. There is an old joke that's been around forever that says that the Church of Christ will have their own little corner of heaven so that they won't know that the rest of us got there, because if they found out we were there, it just wouldn't be heaven for them. So external religion still runs rampant through the church. People who think that you can satisfy God or obligate God through your external activities, your external actions. The problem is, if you want God to accept you on the basis of your actions, he already gets it. Then he has to judge all your actions. You don't get to just go in and say, well, there was this one time that I did something really good and I'd like you to pay attention to that. Instead, he's going to say, well, okay, if that becomes the modus operandi, if that's the way we're going to figure you out, if that's the way we're going to look at you, let's take a look at your life and size you up. Is the right response. You don't want God to size you up on the basis of your actions because you're not going to cut it. I think we're all okay with that. We all know. In fact, remember that by the law, if you fail in any one point, you have failed in its entirety. So think of your one point. Oh, that didn't take long. So then external religion can't get it. Christianity is about internal religion, internal faith, internal spirituality. That is why God said and why Christ said that God is looking for those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Huge conflict in the first century church. Now, they knew via the Mosaic law that there were certain things like eating pork that they couldn't do. Let's be clear here. Pigs are not sinful in and of themselves. They're animals. They can't do righteousness. They can't do sin. They are not inhabited by the Holy Spirit. They have no intrinsic goodness or badness.
They have no soul.
They have no soul. Exactly. They're animals. So whether or not you eat a pig has nothing to do with your relative righteousness or lack of it. Got it? But God did say, don't eat pigs. He did say it. Now, I believe that that was a good, healthy rule. I believe that he made up that rule on purpose and he knew what he was saying. He said, eat these animals, don't eat those animals. Those were good, healthy, conscientious things to do. They turned it into a form of religion where it became intrinsically evil to eat a pig. Okay, now, Jesus comes on the scene dealing with Jews who are trying hard to keep the law. And he takes the law a step further in his Sermon on the Mount and says, you know, it's not just whether or not you can keep the externals, but God who knows your heart is going to look on your heart and go all the way to your intention. So then he said, You've heard it said, Jesus spoke like an evangelist. And he said, you've heard it said. Suddenly I'm Ernest Angley. Sorry. Jesus came along and said, you have heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But then he took superiority over the law and said, but I say to you, and he fully expected when he said that, that they would understand that he was taking greater authority than the law. They were walking, living, acting under the Mosaic law. He comes along and says, you know, you've heard the law say to you, you should not commit adultery. But I say to you, to any Jew who ever did that, well, the law says this, but I say, well, that's good for stoning right there. You don't ever question the law of God. And yet Jesus assumed an authority over the law and said, but I say unto you, that if you lust after a woman in your heart, you're guilty as an adulterer. So here's all these guys running around who said, well, simply because I haven't done it, I'm free of that charge. And Jesus said, did you ever look at a woman and lust at her? And they, yeah. And he goes, guilty. You've heard it said, thou shalt not kill. And they all went, well, we've never killed. But I say to you, if you hate your brother in your heart, you're guilty as a murderer. Went right past the physical doing into your heart and into your intentions. Paul picked up on that very thinking in Romans 14, and he turned it the other way now and said, let's talk about your conscience and the intention of your heart. There are certain things that the New Testament says don't do. That's clear. The Old and New Testament both say don't do murder. So now that you know that the Bible says don't do murder, it is impossible for you, unless you're a genuine sociopath, It's impossible for you to go murder thinking that it's okay and God doesn't mind. You're aware that he said, don't do it. But there are other things that were said in the Old Testament that weren't carried over into the New that Paul now is going to say, these are matters of conscience. For instance, there were Jews who kept the Sabbath. They still believed that the Sabbath was the high day. But when Jesus rose on Sunday, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Christian groups started getting together Sunday morning, the first day of the week. That's why we meet on Sunday mornings. The first century church started meeting Sunday mornings. Now, you all know that Sunday is not the Sabbath, despite all sorts of confusion in the church, where there are people who call Sunday the Sabbath day because they meet on. Sabbath means what? What is?
Seven.
Very close.
Seven.
It means seven. It means the seventh day. Saturday is always the seventh day. To this very day, go get yourself a Gregorian calendar. There's one hanging in there, and you'll see that Sunday is the first day of the week, and Saturday is the seventh. Sabbath is always the seventh day. That's Saturday, no matter what you do about it. But there were first century Christians that still wanted to keep the Sabbath. The sign of the Mosaic Covenant, the seal of the Mosaic Covenant, was the Sabbath. That every seventh day, they would stop what they were doing, they wouldn't leave their homes, they would dedicate those days to God, and they continued to do it. So Paul says, if you're keeping the Sabbath to God, because you are so committed to God that you continue to keep it, Paul said that becomes a matter of conscience, and you can do it. However, he then said there are others, especially the Gentiles, who were never under the Sabbath, who in complete freedom of worship to God in spirit and truth, don't keep the Sabbath. And to them, as a matter of conscience, they don't. But they don't keep it because of the freedom they have in God. So Paul says, is either one better than the other? Well, no. In fact, what you're going to see, and this is what I really want you to see, is that Paul's going to say, the people who are wound up in these traditions that they can't get rid of, those are actually the people who are weaker brethren, who are weaker in their faith, but that true Christian faith results in freedom. Freedom of will, freedom of conscience. So he's going to say, if you have a free conscience, so that you don't keep the Sabbath or that you do eat meat, we'll get into that in just a second. If you have that kind of freedom of conscience, he says, what do you do about your weaker brother who is still wound up in these rules, who is still wound up? What do you do about that guy? And Paul, because he's Paul, consistent with everything we've been talking about for the last 10 weeks, says, instead, you bind your own freedom for the sake of the weak brother. And if you have that freedom, you have it before God. But if it would offend this guy, don't do it. Instead, go have that freedom before God, but in front of that brother, don't make that brother confused. Don't make him stumble. Don't upset him over his traditions. Instead, wait until God has equally freed him, and then you can both go enjoy your freedom together. I'll give you an example. Alcohol. Wine. I'll speak specifically of wine. Wine is an inanimate object. It can't sin. It can't do righteousness. It is a liquid in a glass or bottle. You can throw a Bible at it all day long and tell it to be holy, but it can't do it. You understand that? Neither can it do anything wrong. It's a liquid. It can't do anything good or bad. The relative good or bad of wine is in the heart of the man who abuses it or uses it. Now, if wine is inherently evil, then when Paul told Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach's sake and his often infirmities, then Paul was enticing Timothy to sin, if wine is inherently sinful. Except that in the first century Middle Eastern area, there wasn't a lot of water. And wine was the drink of choice. Go to Italy. Three meals a day, they're breaking out the wine. There are cultures where wine is the primary drink. Now, Paul said, be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess. But he also said to Timothy, drink some wine. It's good for your stomach. I'll be more controversial. There are people who will not take wine with communion in their churches because they are convinced that wine is inherently sinful, so they use grape juice. Right. And they have a lot of rationale for doing it. Their reasons usually have to do with, like, well, number one, if there's children taking, you know, we don't want to develop a taste for wine in the children, or they'll say, We have people in our congregation who have been through Alcoholics Anonymous, and they can't have that first drink. And if they take the wine, we are encouraging them to take that first drink. You know here that when we take communion, we put out wine and we put out water, because wine and water is what's spilled from Christ's side. And if your conscience would be upset by the drinking of the wine, I say, by all means, don't do it. Don't drink wine if it would upset your conscience. Drink water instead. Make sure that your focus is always where it's supposed to be, not on the wine or the water, but on Christ who died. That's the purpose of the communion, is to focus singularly on the finished work of Christ. And so if what you're drinking would get your focus off what you're supposed to be thinking about, don't do it. Don't drink it. Take whatever offends your conscience least. However, there are people outside this room who are offended by the fact that we drink wine, because they've heard the communion tape and they heard me say that very thing and are bothered by the fact that we drink wine. And as I just said, there is no sin in the wine. The sin is in the heart of the person who uses it, or, here's the controversial part, in the heart of the man or woman who judges us for drinking the wine. If we as a group have the conscience to do it exactly as Christ did it, the word in the Greek is oinos, new wine. And it says when Christ supped of the wine, the oinos, new wine, he passed around, they drank it, which was very in keeping with the Passover, when they drank wine at the Passover, very in keeping. It is not grape juice. It is the exact same word that Jesus used when he said, you can't put new wine into old wineskins, or it'll burst the wineskin, because it's fermenting. The fermenting process will burst a wineskin. So you have to have a new wineskin that hasn't yet been stretched. You can put new wine into a new wineskin. Well, if he was talking about grape juice, then all of that is pointless, because grape juice will stay in an old wineskin. It doesn't ferment and it doesn't bust the wineskin. He was talking about a fermenting process that creates an alcoholic drink. And that's the exact same word he used, new wine, oinos, when he drank it at the Last Supper. So I refuse to believe, a lot of the thinking is, and I've heard preachers say this, they'll say, well, wine is, when it ferments, it putrefies, and Jesus would never tell us to put something putrid in our body. I actually heard that one day from a preacher. And yet it is exactly what Jesus put in his body. And so I have no problem of conscience following exactly what Christ did. He took the wine and said, when you drink, think of me. He took the bread, he broke it and said, think of me. I take the wine and the bread and I think of him. However, in this freedom of conscience thing, I'm going to say again, the Bible does declare, Old and New Testament, that there are certain things that are not a matter of conscience. There are some things, like murder, that are not a matter of conscience. They're wrong because they're wrong because they're wrong. Nobody gets away with saying, well, yeah, I killed some people, but it's a matter of conscience, and I'm not bothered by it, and, therefore it's all under the blood, and everything's fine, and, I'm going to be fine. Doesn't exist. Do you know, by the way, that 9 of the 10 commandments are repeated in the New Testament? You know which one isn't? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy is not repeated anywhere in the New Testament. Now, because of that, Paul can then say, one man keeps a day, another doesn't keep a day. That becomes then a matter of conscience to Paul. I've given you the example before of, I've given you lots of examples of this, like me playing drums. I quit playing drums because my ego was so enwrapped in playing drums that it was impossible for me to do without it becoming a source of egocentric pride. It was something I had to quit doing, and so I stopped doing it, because I couldn't do it without attaching notions of fame and fortune to it. It became, for me, individually, something that I had to walk away from in order to be able to serve God with a clear conscience. Now, that doesn't mean that Marcos can't ever play drums. Marcos can play drums all day long. I have no idea if he does or if he ever wanted to or ever did. But the point is, I can't impose my personal convictions on him, because his and my conscience are different. John Crutcher once told me that he couldn't play pool anymore. When he was a young man, he played pool a lot. Apparently he gambled a lot playing pool. Apparently took a lot of money from a lot of people. Played pool a lot, and one day became convicted that he could not play pool anymore. But he knew enough to not say, and either can you. He said, I can't play pool anymore. That was his personal conviction. There are churches out there that believe that playing cards is inherently sinful, that you don't play cards. Oh, I heard a preacher one time say, don't drink Mountain Dew because it creates a taste for beer. I don't know. There are fundamentalist churches out there who say Christians don't dance. I heard a preacher one night say it on the radio, Christians don't dance. I thought, oh, that's weird. I'm a Christian and I dance. That's weird. I had no idea. I don't dance well and I don't dance often. But I've been known to grab the wife and spin her around the floor a couple times. And, you know, not well and not in public, but, you know. But David danced before the Lord. When David brought the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, after it had been in the hands of the Philistines, he stripped himself down and danced through the streets to the degree that it embarrassed his wife.
It didn't take
long either. Yeah, she was embarrassed right away. His conscience was so overwhelmed, he even took off all the kingly robes so that he wasn't dancing as the king anymore, that he was dancing as David the individual, thrilled at the fact that the ark had come back to Jerusalem. Good for David. Individual conscience. Are you getting this? Okay, so now the conflict ensues. I have a conscience, you have a conscience. You have things you're convicted of, I have things I'm convicted of. I cannot impose my convictions on you. You cannot impose your convictions on me. We each individually have the right to go to God individually and deal with our personal convictions before God. And we don't have the right to impose them. But if I go out to eat one night with a fellow Christian who knows I'm a preacher, the waiter comes around and says, would you like something to drink? And I don't drink alcohol. I just don't. I've yet to see anybody drink and become better. I've yet to see anybody drink and become more attractive. Nobody ever drank and then suddenly became smarter, you know. I'll be right in there to do the brain surgery. Let me have a couple drinks. That doesn't happen. And so I just individually became convicted that alcohol was not a thing for me. Because I was working very hard on my coordination as a player, and I couldn't see taking drugs or alcohol that would decrease my ability to do the very thing I was working so hard to do. I was always just too logical to do it. So I'm sitting with another guy who I've just met for the first time, and let's say I did have the freedom to drink, or I'm with somebody who wants a drink. I'm with Mike. Okay, I'm gonna tell stories on Mike. Mike will drink a beer. Okay, I hope nobody, you know, freaks out. Okay. Mike and I go out to eat, and Mike knows perfectly well that when we go to eat, that if he wants a beer in front of his pastor doesn't drink, but his pastor also doesn't put it on him not to have a beer. And Mike will have a beer. In fact, Mike will walk through the door saying, I gotta have a beer. Okay! Mike will have himself a beer. Nor do I make him feel guilty about it, because his conviction and my conviction are different. But you know what? I've never seen Mike drunk. I've never seen Mike drive drunk. I've never seen Mike get drunk and violent and hurt somebody. I've never seen Mike drunk. Now, if Mike wants to have a beer and not abuse the privilege, I'm all for Mike. Now, if Mike wants to get drunk, I'm going to say, now, you know, Paul does in fact lay down a few rules about that. And Mike and I are going to have a talk about it. If Mike decides to go too far as his friend and pastor, I'm going to say, wise up. You're walking a fine line here. But drinking a beer? Eh. So now somebody comes along, somebody we don't know. Say the first time that Jolene came to visit a few months ago, and the three of us go to lunch. Now Jolene is too young to drink publicly. She also doesn't know me as the pastor of this church, and you're the president of this group, an officer in this church, and we go to eat at like O'Charlie's. We sit down. Now Mike's got to give some thought for a minute. We don't know Jolene. And she's too young to drink, and she doesn't know us yet. We don't know the kind of church she came out of or how fundamental it is. And if he were to buy a beer, how would that affect Jolene? Would she be offended? Would she be concerned that the officers of the church were sitting down in the middle of the day having a beer? Well, then before we took the chance of offending her, Paul's going to say, just simply don't do it. Just don't take that chance. In private, the two of you, when you know privately what you're doing, have your freedom. But in front of a weaker brother or sister, somebody you don't know, someone who you might offend, don't risk ruining their conscience. Because what she'll do is one of two things. Either she will say, oh, well, I can't go to that church anymore. You know, they leave here and go out and drink. Or she will, out of confidence in us, say, oh, look, they think it's okay to drink, and offend her own conscience in drinking. Get it? The weaker brother is the one who Paul is concerned with. He said, you that have the freedom, great, you've got the freedom, have it before God. But you should also be the smarter one. And if you come up against a weaker brother who doesn't have the freedom you have, then don't offend him. Have your freedom before God, but be smart enough, wise enough, care enough about your brother not to ruin his conscience and get him to engage in something he otherwise wouldn't do. Now, think it through again. John Riesinger once told me that he got together with a bunch of pastors at a dinner, and the waiter came around with the wine. So now here's their moment. You know, everybody kind of, Well, so the guys who want to prove they have the freedom say, yes, I'll have wine. Yes, I'll have wine. You know, so the wine starts flowing around the table of preachers. Okay, fine. They come to John, and John says, no, thank you. I'd rather not have wine. Well, Brother John, don't you have the freedom? And he stopped them and said, let me explain to you that freedom of conscience is also the freedom to say no. Did you get that one? Freedom of conscience is also the freedom to say no. Just because you have a freedom doesn't mean that you have to go around proving you have the freedom. And if your freedom would cause your brother to stumble, then take your freedom to yourself. Say no, protect your brother. Does that make sense? Okay. Here we go, Romans 14. That was all introduction. Yes, it does not count against my time. Verse 1. Him that is weak in the faith, receive. There are going to be people who are going to come into the church who don't understand things the way we understand them. Everybody in this room started at that point. Everybody in this room came in and didn't get it at first. And then their minds were open, their hearts were open, their spirits were quickened, and suddenly they weren't as afraid of this stuff. All of us, the first time we heard notions of God's sovereignty or predestination or God's right to choose and election, these kind of things, it rubbed up against our flesh and we went, I don't know, that's a hard one to deal with. But as you become exposed to it more and more, and as you see that there's no other way to read Scripture but that way, and as you understand that that's really the only God you want is the one who is sovereign and powerful and chooses, that's the only real security you have. Once you come to understand those things, then you're settled in them. Now, somebody comes into the room who's not as settled as you are. What do? You have all this freedom. You have all this knowledge. You have all this Christian liberty flowing through you. And in comes somebody. Now, are you supposed to accept or reject the fact that they are bound up in these other traditions? And they're bound up in their legalism. And they're bound up in all that stuff. What do? He says, accept them. Accept them as a brother. But, look at the second half, but not to doubtful disputations. In other words, if they're coming in here to argue, no. Not to argument. Doubtful, where they come in and have their doubts about it. And disputing means fighting. I'm not going to debate anybody about the Word of God. I will declare the Word of God to anybody who will sit still and listen. Somebody who wants to come in here and argue about the Bible, their problem's not with me, their problem's with the Bible. They need to go work it out. Now, if you want to argue with me as the leader of this group, we'll meet privately somewhere and argue. But you will not come argue with these sheep. You will not come in here and pretend these sheep are being misled. And you will not come in here and try to tell them the right way to do it, because every one of these sheep know the value of what they're doing, or they wouldn't be here. I tell people all the time, I'd rather be in a room with 10 people I agree with than with 300 people who have no idea what Christianity is. What do you believe? I believe what my church believes. What do they believe? Same thing I do. You know, that, no idea. Receive him that is weak in the faith. I also find it interesting, by the way, that as he defines the man who is weak in the faith here, it's going to be the fundamentalist. It's going to be the legalist. It's going to be the one that would hold you to account and tell you how wrong you are. Paul's going to say, he's the weak one. You who have freedom are the grown-up ones. They think they're the grown-ups. They want to come and tell us, well, you just haven't grown up yet in the faith. You knew anybody. You know any better. I've been there. I've been through that parade. I got the t-shirt. I got the scars on my back to prove it. And you know what it taught me? Legalism. Taught me to be judgmental.
Makes it
more better. Yes. As soon as someone said they were a Christian, the first thing I did was doubt it. Second thing I did was hate them. because I had been taught to hate everybody who wasn't us. Yeah. Jolene's nodding. She knows what that's about. If you're not us, you're not in.
Typical church.
And I was just like that.
But you learned a lot, though.
But I learned a lot. But the cure for wrong use is not no use. The cure for wrong use is right use. And hence, Grace Christian Assembly. Let's go see if we can do it better. So, him that is weak in the faith, you receive, but not to doubtful disputations. Because one believes that he may eat everything. But he who is weak eats only vegetables. Now, what that means is, again, in the first century church, there was a great deal of controversy about what meat you could eat and what meat you couldn't eat. Because, think about Rome, think about Corinth, think about Ephesus. These were great big cities, trading cities. If you think about like Ephesus, the temple to Diana was there. Rome, how many temples to foreign gods were there in Rome? Oh my goodness. The Greek pantheon of gods had been brought into Roman culture. Greco-Roman culture had hundreds and hundreds of gods, and on every street there was a temple to another god. Now, if you were a Christian, you knew that those gods weren't anything. You knew that there was one God and his son, Jesus Christ. So then the meat that was for sale in the marketplace was primarily meat that had been sacrificed to those idols. And then rather than just destroy the meat, they would take it out to market and sell it. So you didn't know when you were out in the market buying some meat to eat, you had no idea whether this meat had actually been sacrificed to an idol or not. So you had a problem with your conscience. Can I eat this because it was sacrificed to a god that is no god? Can I eat it if it was sacrificed to Diana? So Paul's argument is going to be, well, if it's no god it was sacrificed to, then it was an empty sacrifice, eat up.
Yeah.
But some people, for conscience sake, just can't bring themselves to eat that meat, so all they eat is vegetables, then they don't have to deal with it. They become vegetarian. So Paul says, one believes that he can eat all things. That's me. But the other who is weak, now catch that, weak. This guy is too weak to eat that meat, and so he doesn't. So what is the cure? What's the way to approach it? Paul says, verse 3, well then let him that eats, that has the freedom to eat anything, not despise the one that doesn't eat anything. And let not him which eateth not judge him that eats, for God has received him. Now think about that for a moment. He just said, okay, if you've got the freedom to eat anything, don't despise the one that doesn't. That's what too much of church is about, is pointing at everybody else and saying, they're wrong, and they're wrong, and they're wrong, and I hate them, and those people I hate. And Paul just said, no, all they are is weak. They don't get it. They don't understand. You get it. You understand. If you have that kind of freedom, don't despise them for their lack of freedom. And then he says, but you who don't have the freedom, don't judge the ones who have the freedom, because that's the way it always works. They want to come in and tell you not to wear that and to cut your hair a different way and not to use wine and to make sure you do it a certain way and don't dance and don't you go to that club. And I thought you were a Christian. I hear that some. I thought you were a Christian. Well, I am. But I have a different freedom than you have. The ones who are free hate the ones who aren't. The ones who aren't judge the ones who are. But Paul says, don't do that. Don't be that way. Don't act like that. Here's his reasoning. Because God has received him. He belongs to God. He's not yours. So who are you that judges another man's servant? Think about that. Now, in the first century, there were free men and servants. There were slaves and masters. Well, if Mark belonged to me because Mark had a debt he couldn't pay and I paid his debt, so now Mark belongs to me as a servant, it is not up to Mike to judge my servant. He's mine. He belongs to me. If Mike has a problem, he comes to me about it. I'll deal with my servant. Got that? I'll put it a better way. I can spank my kids. They're my kids. Don't you touch my kids. I know for a fact that you don't love my kids to the degree that I love my kids. So I can punish them, and at the same time, they'll know that the punishment is for their good because they know how much Dad adores them. But they don't know necessarily how much you like them, so if you hit them, there's a lot more damage going on there. Got that? And I will defend my children, don't you touch them. Okay, extrapolate out now. Who do you belong to? Well, you belong to God. Who does the weak one belong to? He belongs to God. So then, who are you to judge another man's servant? If he is serving God, but wrapped up in his fundamentalism, and you are serving God, and you are free, you have no right to judge each other because you don't belong to each other. You are each belonging to God. You got a problem with him? Go to God about it. God will free that man's conscience. How did your conscience become free? Exposure to the word, and then over time you start thinking, hey, that thing I thought was so upsetting isn't upsetting anymore. Oh, that thing I was worried about, I'm not so worried about anymore. Oh, this freedom takes you over. Christ said, whom the Son sets free is free indeed. What was he saying when he said that? He was saying it to people who were wrapped up in legalistic religion, the Jews. And he said, but I've come to set you free, that you may have life and that you may have it more abundantly. And so then the church turned it upside down and said, come be a Christian and we'll tell you what to do and what not to do, and we'll wrap you up in all this legalism and take you right back to that lack of freedom that Christ came to give you. Let me put one more caveat in here. You can't free evil people. If you give evil people freedom, they'll run wild and all sorts of hell will break loose. If there were no rules, no laws, then we would in fact have anarchy. You got to have some rules. The reason you have to have rules, just like the law of God, is to keep evil people from doing evil things. The reason we have laws on the book is to keep bad people from doing bad things. You can only free good people who have good intentions and who will do good things. You get that? You can only give genuine freedom to people you trust. And the only reason God trusts you enough to free you is that he put his spirit inside you to guide and direct and draw you. You can give freedom to a person who is being controlled by the spirit of God. You can't free a man who's being controlled by the devil. Free a man who's being controlled by the devil and he will show what he is and he will go into all sorts of devilish activities. But if you free a man who's driven by the spirit and let him do what he wants, he will naturally do those things that please God. You don't have to put rules on a guy who naturally wants to please God. If he naturally wants to please God, he will know that God said the way you treat your brothers is indicative of what you think of me, and so then he can give freedom inside the church, because the church will care for itself, protect itself. Are you getting what I'm saying? The reason Christ could bring this extent of freedom to the church is because he knows that he is Lord over the church. And then we are bond slaves to our Lord, who gave us the complete freedom to serve him completely. Sounds like a dichotomy, doesn't it? But the only real freedom you've got is your freedom to either sin and be rejected or be free to serve God. Your natural state is bondage to sin and you have no freedom to serve God. Your natural state after the flesh is bondage to sin and the inability to please God. Until he frees you from that, and then you're finally free to serve him. That's true freedom. Genuine freedom is the ability, finally, to serve God in spirit and truth. And you can't serve him in spirit if you don't have the spirit, which he gives. And you can't serve him in truth if you're an inherently evil person who doesn't want the truth. God, are you getting this? Yes? Not if you are. These are huge concepts that the church at large won't tell you, because the church believes that if you don't keep people under bondage, that anarchy will break out in the church. I believe just the opposite. I want you to have the complete and whole, total freedom that Christ intended for you to have, because I know that if his spirit is inside you, you will not abuse that freedom. You will naturally follow after what God would have you do, and I trust God more than I trust you. Yeah?
If they're saying yeah. That, basically they don't trust God.
Yeah! Yes! Yes.
God, they trust them all themselves.
Because they believe that they must tie you up in all that legalism and fundamentalism and stuff, otherwise you'll wander off. They don't trust God, they don't trust you, they don't trust the Spirit of God. They believe that they have to lord their power over you because they have forgotten whose the sheep are. You don't belong to me. None of you belong to me. I have no power over you. I have no ability to change you, move you, or have you do anything. But I know this. I know this word can change you and move you. I know this word has power, and I know the one who has authority over you, and I know who you belong to, because I belong to him too. And I've been given a commission by him to take care of you and teach you and guide you and lead you and feed you. So I do, because I take all that stuff seriously. But I know who you belong to. All right, let's just plow forward here. Who are you that judges another man's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Yea, he shall be held up, because God is able to make him stand. So the one who wants to come in here and judge us, we don't belong to him, we belong to God, and we'll be okay because it's God that holds us up. You think? Number 5, verse 5. One man esteems one day above another day, but another man esteems every day the same or alike. So let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. So one man says, we got to keep the Sabbath. Well, then you know what? That man better keep the Sabbath. Because in his own mind, he is persuaded that that's the way it's supposed to be. But to another man, you esteem every day alike. To me, every day is every day. I worship God every day. I don't wait till Sunday to do it. I hold every day as the same because this is the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. So I esteem every day the same. I like Sunday better because I get to see you all. But every day is the same. But there are other people who believe that they, you know, Sunday is the high day and the holy day, and you don't work on Sunday, and you don't watch football on Sunday, and you don't... Well, okay, if you're persuaded of that, by all means, live it out. Because you have before God established that as a rule in your conscience before God. And so it becomes a rule for you. But don't get mad at me if I don't share your rule. One man esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. Now he that regards a particular day, regards it unto the Lord, like the Sabbath. He that regardeth not the day, well, to the Lord he does not regard it. That's me. He that eats, eats to the Lord, because he gives God thanks. And he that doesn't eat, to the Lord he eats not, and he gives God thanks. For none of us liveth to himself, and no man dieth to himself. For whether we live, then we live unto the Lord, and whether we die, then we die unto the Lord. Whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. So, I'm going to stop right there. There's so much more to this. I got 4 other books we still got to get to in the Bible just to cover the subject, so we may be here for several weeks. But by the time we get done with this, you're going to understand Christian freedom. You're also going to understand how to be tolerant with your weaker brethren who don't think they're weaker, they think they're stronger. But Paul's summary point right here is, if a man belongs to God and so he has certain convictions, and you belong to God and you have certain freedoms, you both live to God and you both die to God. So then what do? You accept each other, you don't judge each other, and you don't despise each other. And when the weaker brother comes around, understand that he's weaker. And because he's weaker, he's going to say stuff, and he's going to do stuff, and he's going to be a real pain. And he's going to say judgmental things. He's going to rub you the wrong way, and you're going to say, oh, that guy is so tied up in his legalism, what am I going to do? What you do is you talk to the one who owns him. You pray for that man. You hope he'll stick around long enough to hear the things you've heard. And if he does hear them and take them to heart, someday he'll share the freedom you have. And that should be your desire. Wouldn't you rather that we have more people be set free by this gospel instead of being put into the bondage that the church is out there putting everybody in? I can't go to church anymore. I visit churches and it just drives me nuts because they bind people up in their bondage. I'll give you an example. My mom and I one time, Christmas, many, many years ago, we went out to the church there in Shelbyville that Mom and Dad were going to at the time. And it was a Christmas service, and they decided to have communion. The preacher read from Corinthians where it says, let a man examine himself, for he that eateth or drinketh unworthily drinks to himself judgment. Damnation in the King James, but it's crema, judgment. And he read it this way. He said, so let a man examine himself, for he that eats or drinks unworthy drinks to himself damnation. And I knew right then that I couldn't participate with these people, because the word is unworthily, the manner of taking, not unworthy. Nobody's worthy. That's the whole point of the communion, is that you need somebody to pay for your sins because you're not worthy. But he instead put a fundamentalist twist on it, where he made everybody feel guilty before they took it and took their eyes off the sacrifice of God and put it on their own unworthiness and then said, now in the next 2 minutes, somehow examine yourself and make yourself worthy. How do you do that? How do you exceed at your own personal worthiness in the next 2 minutes before the cups get to you?
And then how do you drink?
You're drinking unworthy. You're drinking damnation to yourself. Take me kindly. But that whole group that listened to what he said and took it to heart, rather than looking to Christ's finished work, which was the point, looked to themselves. I looked at Mom and said, I gotta go. She agreed with me. We walked, didn't we? We walked. We got outside and I explained to Mom why we left. And she went, oh, I get that. I understand that. That was 10 years ago. Now here she is in the corner. Freedom. That's what I'm talking about. Freedom. Grace, truth, freedom. Christ came to set you free from the religion of the world that wants to bind you up and bind your conscience. I hate the traditions of men that have made the word of God of no effect. I like freedom. I like the Lord that saved me. I really love the God that sent him, and I love the fact that he and I now have direct communication and access. And I can go to the God of ages, the God of the universe, and call him Abba, Father, Daddy. He knows what I am. He knows what I've made of. He knows what I'm like. He loves me anyway. He sent his son to die for me. He put his spirit in me, and he has every intention of graciously giving me the best that he has.